rise. Supreme Court of the State of Colorado is now in session. Chief Justice Bender is back.
Good morning. Please be seated. Our first case is Archuleta versus Gomez, case number 2012-SA-47. Argument is set for an hour. Are both attorneys ready? Okay. A couple of housekeeping matters. First of all, each side has a half hour, and the appellant will have to keep track of your time. And secondly, I wanted to tell you that we'll be using iPads, where we have our briefs, and we can link it into Westlaw. So please, and the record as well, we're not surfing, so you can be aware of that. Are you both ready? Let's go. On the one thing, please state your name and who you represent at the beginning of your argument. Thank you.
My name is Max I. Exline, and I represent the Ralph Archuleta Living Trust on this appeal from a limited remand. This case was remanded by this court. Initially, there was a trial, and before Judge Mays, and he denied all my clients' relief and found that all of my clients' ditches had been adversely possessed. And I appealed that, and one of the main reasons why I appealed was because there was a failure to show consumptive beneficial use on the part of Gomez in his trying to obtain adverse possession of my client's rights. The court here agreed with me, reversed, sent it back down on a remand. The main things this court wanted to see were proof of consumptive beneficial use by Gomez if he sought to claim adverse possession of my client's ditch rights, and by Archuleta if he sought to retain his ditch rights, and to determine how much had been abandoned to the stream. And this was all supposed to be quantified by the trial court. The trial court found that two of my clients' ditch rights were adversely possessed. The trial court found that the Archuleta ditch, which is the number 30 ditch, was adversely possessed. And it found that the Manzanares ditch number 1, which is a number 26 ditch, was adversely possessed. The court found in my client's favor as to the Manzanares ditch number 2, which is a number 31 priority ditch. And my client appeals the trial court's rulings on several other things. There was a request for costs, and the court's judgment ruling did not identify a prevailing party. So the opposing side filed a motion to determine it to be the prevailing party, which in effect sought to modify the judgment that it issued. 63 days after the last post-trial motion was filed, ran, and the trial court never determined who the prevailing party was. And under 59J, we believe that the request to find a prevailing party was deemed denied. Even so, the trial court went on to award around $15,000 worth of costs to Gomez. The other issue is whether or not my client should have gotten a mandatory injunction on the Manzanares ditch number two. My client not only wanted to have him restrained from interfering with his ditch right, but he also wanted the court to make him restore the flow of the Manzanares ditch number two to my client's property. My client pleaded it in his complaint that he wanted that restoration to take place. When the court ruled, the court said, basically, he gets the Manzanares ditch number two, but how he gets it over onto his property is a different matter. Something to that effect. I got the exact words here. And so I filed a Rule 59, and I said, hey, here's your opportunity to say that he has to restore the flow over to my client's property. And the court ultimately said, yes, he has to do that, but unfortunately, my motion was a Rule 59 motion, 63 days passed, and so even though the court wanted to give me the relief that I wanted, it was deemed denied and I didn't get it. The final issue has to do with attorney fees. This court, the first go-around, Judge Mays had awarded attorney fees regarding the Archuleta ditch number 30. This was a ditch which didn't reach my client's property, and this court reversed an award of attorney fees the first go-round, and then on remand, even though the Supreme Court didn't say in its remand order you could pursue attorney fees another time, they pursued attorney fees again on two ditches, the two that we weren't favorably ruled upon, and the trial court denied attorney fees as to both ditches. So the trial court basically said that my client relied upon his expert, and for that reason the court found that attorney fees should not be awarded. The court found that the claim as to the number 30 Archuleta ditch was not groundless and frivolous, and also found it was not lacking in substantial justification. It specifically found that. But they have appealed that. And so those are the issues before the court. And I'm going to go ahead and talk about the first issue that was in my brief, the adverse possession issue. And the fundamental question to be answered today is whether one who seeks to adversely possess a quantity of water must put to consumptive beneficial use the amount he seeks to adversely possess. Can one who only puts part of the intercepted water to consumptive beneficial use be awarded adverse possession as to all that was allegedly intercepted?
Well, you would agree that the head of the flow into the main ditch into a lateral is in a cubic feet per second, correct?
Pardon?
The head of the ditch into the main ditch and then into a lateral is always in rate of flow, is it not?
Yes, the main ditch has a certain rate of flow. Is that what you're asking?
Correct.
Yes.
And then when you take it in a lateral, you're also taking a rate of flow.
Yeah, you're taking a rate of flow, and you've got a deeded amount, or you've got an amount you're trying to adverse possess, and you're trying to adverse possess that amount that the other guy has a lateral coming into his property on.
Correct. And so then what you're intercepting is a rate of flow, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And that quantity of water.
Correct. And it doesn't become beneficial consumptive use till it's applied to the land, in this case irrigation use, correct?
That's correct.
So is there any evidence that your clients ever took a rate of flow on any of the Archuleta land except for this seepage or tail water that we described in the first opinion?
Okay, on the Archuleta ditch you're talking about?
I'm talking about all three of them. Where did the water come from that was actually?
First of all, on the Manzanares ditch number two, they never appealed it, so I don't think that's an issue.
I don't think you're answering the question.
But
the water that irrigated the north pasture of Archuleta, where did it come from?
According to my client's expert, it was water that was left over after Gomez had irrigated with it. The number 30 went over and it stopped at a place called the Harms property, which was west of Gomez.
Right.
And then, according to our expert, due to the topology or topographic specifications of the area, it flowed down into the number 31 ditch, which had been rerouted by Gomez, and it got into the number 31. Number 30 and 31 flowed onto Gomez, where he irrigated his property, and then tailwater that contained both the 30 and 31 entered onto Mr. Archuleta's property.
And in effect, the water court on remand gave your client the benefit of that tailwater as consumptive use or applied water on the Archuleta land. Is that correct?
He did on the Manzanares ditch number two, the number 31, but he didn't on the number 30.
Okay. Did any time, is there any proof in the record that your clients ever diverted a head of flow onto the Archuleta property?
He claims that his father did. He claims that.
But that was before the period of adverse possession, correct?
Well, that's what the court found. Court found it was pre-1968.
So what we have is that the only person who's diverted a head of flow for beneficial use is Gomez, right? During the period of adverse possession.
Here's the problem I have with that. Well, okay, yes, that's what the court found. That's what the court found.
And it's based on evidence in the record, correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
And then I didn't talk about the other ditch. The Manzanares ditch number one did go onto my client's property. It wasn't blocked from going onto my client's property. My client used it. So getting back to your question, my client had a direct flow use of the Manzanares ditch number one. So that was the rest of your answer to your question, I think.
But the adversely possessed water that the water court found was water that Gomez turned onto his property that he otherwise would have not been entitled to, but adversely possessed. And then there is some amount of beneficial use that was made by crops on the Gomez property. Is that the state of the evidence?
That's what the court found. It was contested by my client. My client and his family members testified that he did use the Manzanares ditch number one, and they had some people testify that he didn't, and the trial court decided to have to believe the people who testified that he didn't.
Okay. There's no evidence of the record to show any more consumptive use on the Archuleta property during the claim period of adverse possession than that amount of water that seeped onto or the tailwater flowed onto the Archuleta property. Is that correct?
Only with regard to the number 30 and the number 31, not as the number 26. There's evidence that there was direct irrigation off of Manzanares ditch number one. There was evidence of that. It wasn't tailwater irrigation. It was direct irrigation.
All right, thank you.
This court has stated in Manzanares, or in the Archuleta versus Gomez case, but because actual beneficial use is the basis, measure, and extent of an appropriative water right for irrigation in Colorado, an adverse possession claimant to an irrigation water right has the burden to establish by the preponderance of the evidence the amount of water expressed in acre feet belonging to the deeded owner's water right that the adverse claimant has placed to beneficial consumptive use. My client and I interpret this to mean that in order to adversely possess water, you have to put it to consumptive beneficial use.
Well, isn't there evidence in the record, and didn't the trial court make calculations in the findings of fact that consumptive use was made by Mr. Gomez of the rate of flow that would otherwise have gotten to the Archuleta property?
He made such a finding, as you have said, but he didn't take into account that there was only a 50% farming efficiency alleged, and so only 50% of the water allegedly flowing onto his land was to put to consumptive beneficial use.
That is correct, but that is the average measure generally of an agricultural water consumption. The rest of it is the public's water resource, correct?
Yes.
The return flow belongs to the public.
Yes.
Where have you, on behalf of your clients, established that the Archuleta property is entitled to any of that public water resource that is left over after the application of beneficial use on the Gomez property?
Well, of course, on the Manzanares ditch number one, we claim we directly used it. On the other two, we claim that apparently he was not using all the water because my client was able to irrigate with his water. And so water he wasn't using went back into the system, and my client was able to use it.
How? Would you explain physically how that happened?
Yes. I kind of touched on it a minute ago. The number 30 goes over to the Harms property and then goes on to Gomez's, mixes with the number 31, goes on to Gomez's property. Gomez irrigates. Gomez's irrigation is close to Archuleta's northern pasture. It flows over onto Archuleta's northern pasture.
A return flow is flowing on the pasture.
Yes. Could be return flow, could be just water flowing over the top that wasn't used as well.
Right.
Could be water flowing that wasn't actually used. So there's a reason to limit water adversely possessed that to that which has been beneficially consumptively used, and that's scarcity of water needed for farming efficiency. If Mr. Gomez has his way, he'll be saying, as long as some of the water is put to beneficial consumptive use, you can claim all that is intercepted. If this court agrees with that, it will be giving the one who intercepted the water carte blanche to waste it by using inefficient farming practices. According to Mr. Gomez's expert, Mr. Gomez had a 50% farming efficiency during optimal times, and it was likely to be less. Farming efficiency, you know what that is? It's the percentage of water put onto the property that actually goes into the crops themselves. Some of it grows crops, some of it goes on by. Suppose someone only had a 1% farming efficiency but flowed all the intercepted water on the property to be irrigated. More of the water goes by as return flows in a 1% farmer than a 50% farmer. Why should a person who has 1% farming efficiency get to claim all the water intercepted just as if he had a 50% farming efficiency? Following Mr. Gomez's interpretation that as long as you consumptively use some part of the water intercepted, you get to claim it all, gives an inefficient farmer a license to waste water. The true measure of a water right should be that amount historically consumptively used, not the amount you flow onto your irrigation system. Also, a farmer who only had a 1% efficiency could call out others based on the total amount of water intercepted and prevent water from being put to beneficial consumptive use by others while he wasted it. Gomez claims a 50% farming efficiency. Therefore, at the very most, Gomez could only be awarded 50% of Archuleta's water in the Manzanares Ditch Number 1 and the Archuleta Ditch.
Is the consequence of your argument that that excess water can now be diverted onto your client's lands?
Yes.
And how did you show that, that you weren't adversely possessed from that rate of flow so that even if there was an over-application of water on the Gomez land, the only result is that the water flows back to the public's water resource, and if there was ever a change of water right, Gomez is limited to his historical beneficial consumptive use, enhanced by the adversely possessed Archuleta water. Isn't that the result of our law? You can over-apply, but it's not considered waste in if it returns to the water course and is available for other application. Certainly Gomez would not be able to claim any more than his beneficial consumptive use if he ever tried to sell or change the water right. Isn't that correct?
That's true. But my client was able to use his water. This is adverse possession. It's keeping somebody from using his water. My client was able to use his water. That's what this court recognized in Archuleta versus Gomez, that you can avoid an adverse possession by utilizing tailwater, and that's what my client did. So that's why I think, and you talk about being limited to historical consumptive beneficial use. If you change, for instance, the place of application, that's exactly what Gomez did. He changed the place of application. He changed it from my client's property, allegedly, to his client's property. So might not he be re-quantified based on the historical consumptive beneficial use that he put it to during the 18-year period, which was a maximum of 50% of that which was applied to his property? Why shouldn't he be treated like anybody else changing the place where you apply water? I think he should.
He's within the ditch, is that correct?
Yes, he is within the ditch.
The change of diversion you're talking about is at the head gate, is it not?
Yes.
It's not inside the ditch.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop here. Because I want to have my 10 minutes left.
You may.
May it please the court. My name is Henry Worley. I represent Theodore Don Gomez in this case. I formerly represented his father, Ted Gomez, before he passed away. This case has an interesting history. I've now been representing this family on this case for 11 years. There have been three trials, and this is the third appeal. I want to go right to something that Mr. Exline raised in his brief, but what hasn't been discussed yet, and that was his claim that the water rights that my client intercepted had not been used continuously. He based this on the fact that Gary Thompson, my client's expert, testified that there were, in fact, that overall these ditches were water short, meaning they did not have adequate water at all times to meet all the consumptive use requirements of the crops. But there were times when the, during rainy periods, when there was an adequate natural supply of water for the crops. And Mr. Exline's argument is that during the times when the crop was water long, if my client was applying the water that had been deeded to Mr. Archuleta, in which my client had intercepted, it wasn't really being adversely possessed because there was a break in the continuity because the addition of that water didn't result in increased consumption. I think that this misunderstands the law of adverse possession as it's been in this state, both as to land and to water rights for the last 150 years or so. There has never been a requirement that land be occupied by the adverse possessor every minute of every day, of every week, of every month, of every year for 18 years. That has never been the case. In First National Bank versus Fitzpatrick, it was said, actual occupancy means the ordinary use to which the land is capable and such as an owner would make of it. And in fact, even in the water rights context, it is clear you don't have to use the water all of the time. In Hitchens versus Milner, the Supreme Court indicated that not using an irrigation water right during the winter did not defeat the adverse possessor's claim of continual adverse possession. So I think, simply put, the question is that was raised in Bagwell versus Vihart Ranch, which is whether, under all the circumstances, the use of the intercepted water is consistent with the claimed adverse use. Now, an irrigator in a field such as this, or almost any field, is not going to know where every last, when the crop's consumptive use has been fully met. So when you have the water, you typically apply it, unless you're harvesting the crops or unless it's been very, very wet. So that's something you just can't know. So my belief is that the water court was correct in stating that my client's use of these water rights had been continuous. Now, the other issue that Mr. Exlein did talk about was to what extent does an adverse possessor of water rights gain any rights beyond the amount that is determined to have been consumptively used? And it is very clear that the court made it very clear in its prior decision in this case that it is the amount adversely possessed that the court should look at the amount consumptively used that the court needs to look at to determine whether there, in fact, has been adverse possession. However, I would suggest that in addition to that portion of the water right which is adversely possessed, there is, in fact, that rate of flow which results in return flows eventually, which is part of the water right. It's so without, if somehow the water commissioner could limit future diversions by my client so that they would only divert the additional water that they consumptively used, that would result in consumption of that reduced amount of water of 50%. So instead of, for example, an increase in consumption of approximately, I think, 8.9 acre feet for the Archuleta ditch, if that's all he got to divert, the future consumption of that water right, that adversely possessed portion of the Archuleta ditch, would be some lesser amount, probably, based on Mr. Thompson's testimony, somewhere between 4 and 4.5 acre feet. So I believe that the amount of water that flows with the amount consumptive use, the headgate diversions, consists of two components eventually, not when they're diverted, but eventually they consist of the component that is consumptively used, and then it also consists of the component which returns to the stream either as subterranean return flows or as tailwater. And it seems to me that it would be beneficial, and I hope that the court will clarify that although the consumptive use is all that an adverse possessor would be able to change in a future change case, he does not give up the right to divert that portion of the decreed flow right, which eventually ends up back into the stream for the benefit of downstream water users. In terms of the injunction and the judge's failure to grant all of the relief requested by Mr. Exline's client, the standard of review for an alleged improper grant or denial of an injunction is abuse of discretion. First, I would note that the court, in its primary order, did enjoin my client from interfering with the use of the Manzanares ditch number two.
But don't the facts show that your client filled in the Manzanares ditch number two?
Yes, that's correct, but certainly not while he was under an injunction to not do that, Your Honor.
Well, you know, that's part of the adverse possession, I assume, that was claimed, but the court didn't agree with that because some part of the water still belongs to Archuleta. Isn't that what we're left with?
Oh, yes, that's absolutely correct. The court determined that Gomez had not met his burden of proof in regard to the adverse possession of the Manzanares ditch number two.
And was that the source of the seepage water onto the north pasture or not?
Well, I think that the court determined that we hadn't met our burden of proving that it wasn't the Manzanares ditch number two. And under those circumstances, we're not appealing that decision.
Well, will you remember this case up there in Pitkin County? I think it was called St. Jude's, where
St. Jude's versus Roaring Fork?
Yeah, where the new private hunting or fishing club filled in the ditch and the water court ordered it restored. And we upheld that unless there could be some kind of an agreement to allow access. Now, why isn't this filling in of the ditch subject to an injunction, which the water court didn't give, to restore that portion of the ditch that your client filled in?
Well, I guess the question is, was it an abuse of discretion for the judge to not order? In fact, the judge, as Mr. Exline indicated, did order that my client restore the ditch. But that order was more than 63 days after the...
So why isn't it an abuse of discretion?
Why is it not an abuse of discretion? It is not an abuse of discretion because the court did prohibit my client from interfering with any future work on that ditch by the by Mr. Archuleta. So he's free to go in there with a ditcher, run a ditch along there. My client would be in contempt of court if he knowingly and willfully...
Why should he pay for the cost of something that your client did? That to me sounds totally inequitable, and the fund injunctions are supposed to be equitable.
Well, I don't know. If you determine that it is equitable that my client restore that ditch, I'm sure that he will.
I'm sure of that too. The issue is whether the trial judge made the right decision in this case. And you're saying he did, and I'm trying to figure out... That's just another way of asking the question that Justice Hobbs asked. Why is it not... It sounds like on its face, it's a pretty good case for an abuse of discretion. So why is that right? Wrong, I mean.
Well, I guess I'm not certain. I'm not sure why it's right either. The fact of the matter is that this ditch was filled in apparently around 1968 or plowed over, and the current plaintiff's father sat on his rights from 1968 until his death in 1992. So I guess one answer is that where a person makes no attempt to help himself, I'm not sure why the court should step in and say, oh, well, you didn't do anything for a period of well over 20 years, so we'll now step in and help you rectify the situation that perhaps you should have undertaken yourself many, many, many years ago. I think that's the best answer.
It's some kind of a latches notion, you know?
Yeah.
Inequity.
Yeah, basically.
You know, so what, for over 30 years it's been filled in, huh?
Well, actually, it's been filled in since approximately 1968.
I'm having trouble with time calculations, you know. I'm coming up on my 68th birthday. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
But the point is, you're saying that in equity, you can take a look at the balance of the equities. Now, how much ditch or length are we talking about here? That would have to be reconstructed if your client has to reconstruct
it. It should be right at a quarter of a mile because it goes across a quarter section.
So what the court basically does says on a balance in the equities, I'm not going to require Gomez to restore the ditch, but if Archuleta wants to, there can be no interference because there's an existing right-of-way. Is that basically how it comes out?
That's correct. One thing that my client never really contested was the continued existence of the easement. It's just something we didn't do, so there's no ruling about that. There's certainly no, and even if the easement had been extinguished, if it had been extinguished, there's still the injunction against my client interfering with Mr. Archuleta's use and operation of the ditch across that corner.
Can I ask a question about the timing right over here, Mr.
Yes,
Worley? It sounds to me like you're agreeing with Mr. Exline with regard to the sequence of events. Are you agreeing that the trial judge indicated in some way that he wanted to change his ruling and wanted to require restoration of the ditch but was procedurally barred from doing that?
That is correct, Your Honor.
If that's true, then did he ever exercise his discretion in the first place? What are we to make of that? Did he simply let that slide by? In the initial ruling, did he expressly indicate that your client did not have to restore the ditch?
No, he did not. In the initial ruling, he merely said that my client was enjoined from interfering with Mr. Archuleta's use of the Manzanares ditch number 2. Now, after that, Mr. Exline, on behalf of his client, filed a motion for two things, one of which was to run a ditch across the south end of my client's 40-acre tract over to the south side of his property, south of the Montez ditch, if you've seen the aerial photographs. That hasn't been talked about. The other one was simply that, you know, he couldn't interfere with my client's my client couldn't interfere with Mr. Exline's use of the Manzanares number 2. He filed the motion, and I have no idea what was going on in Judge May's mind.
I guess where I was sort of going with that, mm-hmm. if I could interrupt a little, is you indicated that the standard would be for us that we would have to decide whether the trial judge abused his discretion in not granting the injunctive relief. But if the judge failed to rule on that claim, would we still be faced with an abuse of discretion standard, or would the question be whether he ever exercised his discretion? And apparently, it sounds like from the sequence of events that he may very well not have and attempted to later, but was simply barred, you're asserting, for a procedural reason. In which case, if he was barred for that reason, would it be natural for us then to say, go back and exercise your discretion on this matter?
I believe he did exercise his discretion. Okay. In the primary order dated October 18th, I think it was, he said, Gomez may not interfere with Mr. Archuleta's use of the Manzanares number 2. Mr. Archuleta requested additional relief, which the court obviously was inclined to grant, but didn't in a timely fashion. But I believe, the only difference really is who pays for this. And that's the only difference. Mr. Archuleta has the right to go in there and reconstruct the ditch without any interference whatsoever from my client.
Counsel, just one more, this end. Just one more quick follow-up on that. Were the both options presented to the water court before the decision was made? I mean, in other words, were you arguing and your opposing counsel arguing you could either enjoin Mr. Archuleta or you could order him to repair the ditch? With both options, I'm trying to figure out what discretion, just like Justice Coates, what discretion was actually engaged in here.
Well, I don't want to misrepresent anything to the court. It's my recollection, and I'm not 68 yet, but I'm having problems with recollection myself. It's my recollection that the restoration of the ditch was something that Mr. Archuleta had always requested, was in his pleadings, and presumably, well, that's as far as I'm going
okay.
to go.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Now, the other thing I'm concerned about this injunction business is, and it also gets into the late order issue, Mr. Archuleta has requested that my client be required to construct a ditch across the southern part of his property so that it goes over and he can irrigate the area south of the Montez ditch. In his order, which was determined, which is void because it was too late, Judge May said, there's no evidence that that ditch ever went there, or at least he found that it hadn't ever gone there. And if you look at the part of the record that's cited by Mr. Exline, it's at best very, very, very ambiguous that his client was testifying that there was ever a ditch across the southern part of the 40-acre tract over to the southern part of Mr. Archuleta's property. And I do not think it was an abuse of discretion for him to not order that. I don't think that was anything that was ever requested until the very end by Mr. Archuleta. Costs I want to address briefly, kind of an interesting issue. Costs come under Rule 54, not Rule 59J. There's a case, Meyer versus McCoy, in which I think it was the Court of Appeals said that a court's award of costs beyond the, I think it was at that time, 60-day period, was valid because costs are not subject to Rule 59J. They're governed by Rule 54, and there is no 60 or now 63-day limit on an award of costs. One thing that occurred to me for the first time as I was sitting here this morning is he's made the argument that the motion that Gomez be determined to be the prevailing party was in fact a motion to alter or amend the judgment. I guess my question is, well, under that circumstance, it would have been untimely. The judge's order granting costs would have been untimely. However, if the motion for costs was made in a timely fashion, which it was, it seems to me basically immaterial when the judge decided that my client was the prevailing party because he issued a separate award of costs. So I'm not sure that, I don't know whether I made the point I was trying to there, but I think it's immaterial perhaps that the judge later issued a written order saying, yes, Gomez is the prevailing party. Instead, he granted the costs, and that was that. The attorney fee issue, I don't want to spend a lot of time on, but in this case, Judge Mays specifically determined, and I want to quote this, use of tailwater from the Archuleta ditch on Archuleta's property is clearly contrary to all the credible evidence presented in this matter, and he even underlined the word all. My point is, when something is clearly contrary to all the credible evidence, that is the definition of something being substantially groundless. What he later said in denying my motion for attorney fees was, Well, you know, Jeff Clark is a reputable engineer, and Mr. Archuleta relied on Jeff Clark's testimony. The fact of the matter is, the court had also found that Jeff Clark had been fed a steady diet of inaccurate information by his client, which he reasonably relied on. But given that it was all inaccurate, how could Mr. Archuleta's reliance on Mr. Clark's testimony how could that be justified? I think the answer is no, it isn't.
Isn't the answer is that we find it very difficult in a water case to say anything is frivolous?
Well, I guess.
I mean, if you look at our jurisprudence, we've let by some pretty skinny arguments.
Well, you know, I mean, it's for you to decide. Well, I guess I would suggest that if there is a time when this court is willing to determine that an argument in a water rights case is substantially groundless, this is that case.
Well, Mr. Worley, doesn't the statute require the trial judge to make specific findings?
Yes.
And he didn't make those, right?
That is correct.
So I don't see, whether it's frivolous or not, in fact, I don't see how you get your fees.
Well, what I said was...
I understand your argument. Your argument is that it doesn't make a lot of sense given his findings about the merits. But he never made the right findings under the statute. We're bound under the statute. That's it, right?
Well, what I said under... And this is something in some ways I may regret. But what I said was that the relief I requested was that this be remanded once again for the sole purpose of determining the reasonableness of the attorney fees.
Well... That would be the reasonableness of the fees is a different question from whether fees get awarded at all. In other words, that's how much you charge an hour, whether it costs, you know, that sort of thing. But the idea of awarding fees to a prevailing party, the statute has to be followed. I mean, we're bound by that, right?
Yes, I don't think that you could. Yes, I don't think
so,
that you could
so
say
we
yes.
We can't just disregard the statutory command that in order to award fees, you got to make these specific findings. It says shall.
I agree. That's absolutely correct. In the case, so, that limited issue would have to be remanded to the court, which might.
But he didn't do it. So what? It's a do-over again, or what? I mean, I don't.
Well, that's the only way that fees could be awarded. Yes. I think I've said everything I choose to say, unless you have some specific questions.
I guess I'm interested. Was there any estimate of how much it cost for this ditch on the Manzanares ditch to be number two, priority 31, to be redone or opened up? What's the cost?
Virtually nothing.
What was it? Was there evidence of that?
No, there wasn't. But I think I said in a footnote, this is not a matter of record. My client represented to me that he has gone out and reconstructed that ditch with his ditcher, and that it's there, and that the culvert that the court required was also installed at his expense, purchased and installed.
Mr. Gomez, you make that representation as an attorney? That he told you that, I understand.
Oh, yes. He told me that, and I believe him.
Okay. Thanks.
Anything else? Thank you very much.
Your Honor, I didn't get to talk about this water long situation. I do want to mention it briefly. We believe if he has months of when water long exists, then he's not putting it to consumptive beneficial use. He's not putting it to any use at all, and this interrupts the chain of continuousness for adverse possession. In other words, if a person can have a month of non-use, doesn't that interrupt the chain of adverse possession? And his expert testified there were spotty periods when he had these periods of non-use. And so I don't think the court has a way to tell how many times he had water-long months. There was no quantification of the number of water-long months there were. And with a lack of quantification, the trial court could only speculate whether or not he was continuously using the water.
Mr. Exline, could I take you back to the fundamental question here, back beyond the continuous use, and just the question about the quantity that can be acquired by adverse possession? I'd just like to make sure I understand your argument. Seems to me your opponent basically characterizes your argument as being that what we meant in our earlier opinion was you can only acquire by adverse possession not the amount, the flow that you've actually diverted for the adverse period, but rather only the duty of water on that adverse flow. Is that your argument? So if it's half, let's say half.
My argument is the amount consumptively beneficially used.
You're saying that you understand our opinion to mean that the amount you actually consumptively used is the only amount of diversion that you can acquire by adverse possession?
That's the way I understand it, based on the quote that I read at the beginning.
So that would come out, as I understand the way Mr. Worley characterizes that. Do you agree that what you'd be saying is if you diverted X flow for the adverse possession period and you applied it to a usage that only amounted to consuming 50% of it, then you only acquired the right to divert 50% of the amount that you had actually been diverting for the last 18 years?
That is my argument.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to move on to another issue. Well, first of all, I want to go back. My client testified that rerouting of the number 31 and the stopping of the flowing of the number 31 occurred much later than 1968. And I think that goes to the latches argument.
Mr. Klein, can I ask you a question? Mr. Worley just represented off the record as an attorney that's been taken care of. The ditch is made whole. Is that accurate? Or is that true?
Not that I know of. I don't think he restored the flow onto my client's property. What he said he did was bring it up to the edge of the road, I think is what he said. It's in his brief, and I can't remember exactly what he said, but that's what I think he said. He didn't actually restore the flow to my client's property. He brought it to the edge of the road. There's a road that goes between his property and my client's property, so he brought it up to his side of the road. That's what I understand.
And then he added there was a culvert, which I assume would continue the continuity of the ditch to get it onto your client's property. Is that right?
There isn't a culvert.
No?
In fact, this is off the record, but when he thought that Judge Mays's order was a valid order, he said, "We bought this used culvert. We can put this used culvert in if we're going to follow Judge Mays's order," which eventually it became clear that Judge Mays's order was void under 59J, so nothing happened after that. But there wasn't a culvert. On the cost issue, Rule 54 says costs shall be allowed as of course to the prevailing party. So Rule 54 pre-assumes a prevailing party has been identified. And contrary to what he said, I raised in my brief the fact that the court never ordered a prevailing party. He was trying to change the order. It looked a lot like a Rule 59 motion to modify a judgment. And since 63 days ran under 59J, the court could not determine a prevailing party. Therefore, no prevailing party was determined, and no cost could be awarded. The court essentially found, like one of the cases that I cited, that, yeah, it was Remote Systems versus DeLanges. The effect of the court's order is to say nobody prevailed, not award any fees. So I think the court lost its ability to say award fees whenever the finding of prevailing party was void.
Does the designation of a prevailing party have relevance with regard to anything other than an award of attorney fees?
Not really.
And so I'm not sure I'm seeing why you think that's something that had to be decided as part of the merits of the case rather than part of a motion for attorney's fees.
I think that because Rule 54 says you have to have a prevailing party before you can award fees, and you didn't get the ruling of a prevailing party in time, that you can't award fees.
I guess, so in one way, another way of asking that, that's causing me a little concern, is in ruling on the merits, the court has decided, in a sense, who has prevailed. Now, to designate somebody a prevailing party is a category that has implications only with regard to the giving attorney's fees. And so that's why I'm kind of concerned, has whatever had to be done in the merits of the case not already been done in terms of deciding who's prevailing, but in terms of deciding for purposes of attorney's fees whether that order qualifies as making somebody a prevailing party? Is that not simply something that's strictly...
Justice Coates, costs, not attorney's fees.
Well, okay.
Costs, yes. It is something only related to cost. It really is. But I still think, technically, it was too late to identify a prevailing party.
And fees are part of cost. Is that right in this context?
Fees are not a part of cost.
No, that's not what we're arguing about. Okay.
Fees is a separate issue, and I was going to get to that.
It could be expert fees.
Yeah, okay.
Expert fees.
Yeah, expert fees is.
Right.
And there was like 15,000 in expert fees. Attorney fees, the requirement of this court is to determine, well, I'm gonna back up for a minute. Meyer, they cited Meyer as controlling. They said, Meyer says that Rule 59J doesn't apply. Only Rule 54, I'm out of time, I'm sorry.
You can finish your answer.
Only Rule 54 applies, and 59J does not affect Rule 54. Meyer, in that case, the defendant won hands down, and there was no question. He got a jury verdict in his favor on all counts. So it wasn't necessary to identify a prevailing party in Meyer because the court had already done it. So I think that's what distinguishes Meyer from this case, is because it was obvious who the prevailing party was.
Are there any other questions? Did you want to go ahead, Mr. Justice Coates? Thank you very much, Mr. Exline.
Thanks, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Worley. The case will be submitted on the briefs. I thank both of you for arguing a second time in front of us. And we'll present.